Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
Listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Thanksgiving has always been associated with turkey, but maybe you're feeling a bit rebellious, or maybe you don't especially like turkey. Well, Melissa Clark joins us today to share her alternatives to traditional fare for next Thursday's meal, and she'll also be discussing some of the suggestions you wrote in earlier this week. Plus, I'm sure she'll be taking some questions about common issues like the best gravy and pie and whatever else you're curious about. Melissa Clark is a reporter for the Food Department of the New York Times. Her column, A Good Appetite, appears Wednesdays in their food section. And you can also follow her on Twitter at Good Appetite. Melissa, it's always a pleasure to have you here.
Pleasure to be here.
And for our audience, if you have a suggestion, a question, your opinions are many, as we have learned. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692 or write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. Or if you are one of those people who just is very terse, why not tweet? Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Facebook's great as well. So, Melissa, are you a traditional kind of person when it comes to Thanksgiving?
I struggle. Thanksgiving is a struggle because on the one hand, I want to be traditional. I mean, I don't make turkey any other time of the year except for Thanksgiving. And I like turkey. I mean, I don't love turkey, but I like it well enough. So I figure this is my chance to make turkey. But then the struggle is, well, what about all those other wonderful options that I also don't make? Like, how often do I roast a duck, right?
How often do you roast a duck?
Probably even less than I roast a turkey, which is really sad. So then I think, well, maybe I should have a roast duck instead, or maybe I should have a roast duck alongside. Or what about a pheasant? I never roast a pheasant. Isn't Thanksgiving the perfect time to seek out something a little bit unusual?
So, where do you get a pheasant?
Probably the same place you can get a turkey, probably a butcher shop. Oh, I know, you can get them at butcher shops, you can get them at the farmer's market. But it's a struggle between wanting to be traditional and wanting to eat what everybody else in America is eating at that moment, which is actually very special, and also wanting to go my own direction and do something new. So I have a struggle, and pretty much every year we end up with the turkey, and then maybe I'll do a little something that's special on the side, you know, like I'll go crazy with the side dishes, or I'll go out on a limb with the dessert. But it's finding that balance, and you also don't want your family to rebel against you. You know, if your family is expecting turkey and you serve them duck, that could get a little bit messy.
Some of the complaints about turkey are, well, all of those leftovers. And also, some people complain that it makes them feel sleepy.
The tryptophan. Yeah. Yes, that is true. Turkey does make you feel sleepy, and it's all those other carbs that you're eating during the meal. But you know what? Embrace it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being sleepy after a big meal. Enjoy that feeling. Take a nap if you have it early enough.
In fact, if the conversation is some families can get rather heated, maybe that's a good idea to say, you know, I'm feeling a little sleepy. I'm going to go in the other room.
I could calm everybody down.
Will you be hosting this year, or do you go somewhere else and bring some things?
Well, I go to my parents' house in Brooklyn, and I always bring the turkey. And this is my great discovery about 5 years ago, was that if you spatchcock your turkey,
let's take the backbone
that you
out.
Take the, and you can actually have your butcher do it. I have done it in the past, but it's the turkey bones are quite thick, so you really need to have some muscle. So you can ask someone else to do it for you, or if you want to do it yourself, there are some great videos on the internet which will show you exactly how to do it. I know the New York Times has one. But what's great about it is that once you take the backbone out and you stretch the turkey, you butterfly it, and you stretch it out on a roasting pan, it will cook in half the amount of time that it takes if you just leave it whole, because the heat is the hot pan is touching it directly. So it starts to heat immediately. And also, because you have the thighs laid out flat, they cook more quickly, and they cook at the same rate as the breast. So not only does it cook more quickly, it cooks more evenly. So I highly recommend spatchcocking.
Do you recommend that for other birds, like a duck or a chicken?
I should try it for a duck. I've actually never spatchcocked a duck. Why not? Yeah. I'm going to try that. But it works beautifully for chicken. It is one of my favorite ways to have chicken.
One of the reasons I think a lot of people serve turkey on Thanksgiving is it's often a dinner for a lot of people.
Yes.
And turkey can take care of that. You got to do two chickens or a couple of ducks if you're going to have 15 or 20 people.
Well, our Thanksgivings have been getting smaller, so we're only about 12. So we can do one turkey is perfect for us. But in the I was thinking about this, you know, as I've been thinking about alternate Thanksgivings and things that what would I really do if I could do anything? If I had a large crowd, I think I would do a small turkey and a couple of ducks, because that way you could have it all. You could have the traditional, you could have something a little bit new, plus all that duck fat that you get, that extra duck fat. You could also do a goose. And we don't celebrate Christmas with a big bird. That's not what we do in our family. So I'm not going to have duck or goose or a ham or anything like that later on. Like, Thanksgiving is our feast. So maybe if I can get it all on the table at the same time.
Well, one of the problems with duck for many people is it's so fatty.
Yes.
When you go to Chinatown, you see all these ducks hanging in windows. And that's because they are draining out the fat before they roast them. But
yes.
I can't imagine doing that in my house.
Okay, well, there is a very easy – no, well, it's not that easy, but it's easier than letting the duck drip for a couple of hours. There's a good way to get rid of some of the fat. But you don't want to get rid of all of the fat. You want some of that fat. You don't have to eat it, but you can. It renders out of the duck, and then you save it, and you use it to fry potatoes, or you use it for making pie crust.
It's not high cholesterol?
Well, you know, there's – that is not my main concern. My main concern is deliciousness. But
Before you go on, a listener has called in to say they were interested in trying turkey confit, so they used turkey legs and duck fat.
Oh, that's so smart. Yes. See, that's what you need to save your duck fat for turkey confit so we have a recipe on your website, by the way, which has – it's a duck recipe. And what I do is – have you ever had confit potatoes where you cook potatoes in fat until they just melt? So what I do is I put the potatoes on the bottom of the pan, and the duck renders all its fat, and it covers the potatoes, and you're confiting the potatoes at the same time that you're roasting your duck. So you're using that good duck fat for another purpose to make these delicious melting potatoes. Now that is a good recipe.
It's called honey roasted duck, but it also says apple confit.
Yeah,
you're making an apple confit as well?
You slice up some apples and you put them with the potatoes. Adds a little bit of sweetness. You could skip, I mean, really it's the potatoes. I think it should say apple and potato confit. They're married down there.
Now, you also brine the duck, and there are some people who say when you're doing a roast chicken that you don't need to brine it. You could just put salt on it and let it sit. But are you one of those people who prefers brine?
Okay, so there's two kinds of brines. There's something called a dry brine, which is what I use, and a wet brine. And a wet brine, and this is for any poultry or for pork, you can brine pretty much anything. I know a lot of people will be brining their turkeys this year. And if you use a wet brine, you're making a solution where you're dissolving the salt in water and you're adding aromatics and you're soaking your protein, whatever you're using, in this wet liquid. I prefer a dry brine where you rub the salt on top of it and then let it sit. It absorbs the same amount of salt. It will cure. It'll, you know, season and retain moisture just as well. And you don't have to worry about a big sloppy thing of brine. Like, where do you put that?
Well, I put it in the refrigerator in my basement.
But I don't have a refrigerator in my basement.
But it also gives you the opportunity to put some garlic in the brine and bay leaves and
you
anything else.
You can do that with a dry brine. You can just mash it up. Mash up the garlic with your salt. Mash up the bay leaves with your salt. Make a paste. Make a salt paste. Rub it all over. And then put that in the fridge. And you don't have to. It's just, I find it less messy. However, both of them work really well.
And you're refrigerated overnight.
For the duck, I'll do overnight. For turkey, you could brine it a couple of days ahead if you have, you know, whether you're using a dry brine or a wet brine, you can do a few days ahead.
And some people believe in buying a kosher turkey, an Empire brand turkey, because it's already salted, it's already brined.
Exactly. Never salt or brine. I mean, you can salt it, but don't brine a kosher turkey. It's already been brined for you because they have injected it with salt. They've treated it. So it is nicely seasoned.
You also blanch your duck?
Okay, so that's what I was going to say. So another way to remove some of that excess fat and also to tighten the skin so you get a very crisp skin is to take your duck, and this won't work with you need to have a smallish duck. It won't work with a goose. I guess any size duck is small enough, but you take your biggest stock pot, you boil some water, and then you take your duck and you just slip it in for a couple of minutes just to blanch it. It tightens the skin. It removes some of the excess fat. And then you take it out, you know, pretty quickly, and you save some of that duck broth. Basically, you've created, it's not very flavorful, but you've created this duck blanching liquid, and you can use that as the liquid in your recipe.
Do you stuff the duck as well?
I do not. I don't even stuff a turkey. There's a big debate. I think fewer people are stuffing turkeys. I mean, I know that there's a couple of issues with stuffing turkeys. One is safety. In order for the turkey to be 100 for the stuffing to be 100% safe, you know, in terms of food safety, it needs to reach 165 degrees. Now, if you put that stuffing inside the turkey, it will take longer to reach 165 than the actual turkey. So by the time your stuffing is cooked through, your turkey is going to be dry. Better to cook the stuffing in a dish on the side, and it'll reach temperature faster than the turkey. And also the turkey will cook more quickly. If you stuff your turkey, it insulates it, and it will slow the cooking of the turkey down.
But if you do stuff the turkey, you be sure to pull all the stuffing out after the meal is over when you're putting all of the leftovers away.
Oh, yes.
Because if it stays inside, it definitely will pick up bacteria.
Yeah. No, if you're at all nervous about you've got poultry, you've got raw eggs in the stuffing, you have all kinds of things going on. You're feeding a very large group of people. It's just better to err on the side of caution without overcooking the turkey. I mean, you don't want to cook your turkey to 180. You want to cook it. You want to take it out at 165, and then you know it's going to be nice and moist and juicy.
You also put wine in the roasting pan?
I put wine in the roasting pan for pretty much anything I'm roasting. I really do because—
Is this white wine or red wine?
You can use either one. White wine is particularly— white wine is better because it sort of disappears. Red wine will, if you have something else in the roasting pan, say you have potatoes, it'll color them, which can be nice. But what you have to worry about with red wine is the tannins. If you have a very tannic red wine and you're using a lot of it and then it's reducing, sometimes it'll taste a bit bitter. With white wine, you don't have to worry about that. And you get the freshness, you get the, usually I want the acid in a wine. So in the bottom of the roasting pan, just a little bit, it helps dissolve the brown bits, the fond. So it makes that more accessible. It brings that into your sauce. And it also adds a little bit of acid, which just brings up all the other flavors.
And most of the inexpensive red wines that you might buy to cook with are likely to be tannic because they're young.
Yeah.
You can let them breathe for a while. But if you don't, that will also have an effect. But then you also brush the duck with honey. You flip it over, and then you, when the breast side is up, you put honey on it?
Oh, yeah, just to make it delicious, golden brown. And the honey encourages browning, and you want this nice, crisp, browned duck skin. You know, no matter what kind of poultry I'm making, whether it is a Thanksgiving turkey, whether it's duck, whether it's chicken, my favorite part is always going to be the skin. I mean, especially with a turkey. That turkey skin is just... And so the more that you can encourage crispness and browning and you can salt it and you can make it really well seasoned, that to me is the best part of any
poultry
meal.
With the duck, you turn it up to 500 degrees at the end to crisp the skin.
Yep.
Would you do that with a turkey as well?
With it, you know, it's funny. Turkeys are, once you, if you have a really good, I feel like if you have a really good thermometer, if you have a good meat thermometer and you're carefully taking the temperature of the turkey and you're being careful not to overcook it, you can actually, there's a lot of latitude about how you can do it. You can do it slow at the beginning and then crisp the skin at the very end. You could start the oven hot. And this is what I usually do is I start the oven hot. I'll start it at 500 or 450, and then I'll bring the temperature down. I find that to have a blast of heat either at the beginning or at the end will give you a better skin than doing it evenly, say at 350 or 325 for longer. But, you know, everyone does their turkey a little bit differently. Some people don't want a dark, crispy skin. They'd prefer something more sort of a pale, golden, even color. I like it to be super dark and almost singed on the ends.
People have been calling in and writing in with their own suggestions.
Excellent.
Including a bunch of vegetarian dishes. And after we take a little break, we'll come back with more of Melissa Clark's suggestions and our listeners' suggestions. Melissa Clark's column, A Good Appetite, appears Wednesdays in what's now being called the food section. It used to be the dining section. You can also follow her on Twitter at Good Appetite. And we have her recipes for honey roasted duck with apple and potato confit and maple bacon glazed pork loin with roast Brussels sprouts and butternut squash on our website. Stay with us for more. We're back with Melissa Clark, whose column, A Good Appetite, appears every Wednesday in the food section of the New York Times. She also has, she twitters at good appetite. And we're inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. If you have alternative Thanksgiving recipes, a lot of people have been writing in, but you may want to call and share one, an alternative to the traditional recipes. A number of people have, as I said, have been writing in. Matthew Setta on Twitter writes, "We spatchcocked last year, and it was the best turkey we ever had. We tried beer turkey, beer can turkey as well, and it came out awfully. It was totally bone dry."
Ah, the beer can. You need a big can of beer. You need a tall boy for
that. That works for chicken, but it doesn't necessarily work for chicken for turkey. Hal from Crown Heights wrote in to say that on the one occasion he hosted Thanksgiving for 14, he did turkey and a beef rib roast.
Oh, that is okay. That is something that, you know, at the Times, we did a big feature spread on the 50 states of Thanksgiving. It came out yesterday. And one of our states was Nebraska, which I did personally. And in Nebraska, apparently, I mean, not all of Nebraska, but there are pockets of Nebraska where people serve a standing rib roast along with their turkey because it's such a beef-oriented culture.
Well, Omaha Steak is out of
Nebraska. And it's fabulous.
Nebraska.
And so I absolutely say that I love that idea, and who doesn't want a little beef with their turkey?
We are going to be talking a lot about China during the show. Lisa from Brooklyn wrote in to say that they do Peking duck.
Oh, great.
But this year they're going to try pig face or clam pie.
I don't know what pig. I don't know how to make a pig face, but that sounds delicious. I would love that. That would.
I'm not sure I want a pig looking at me on Thanksgiving. I feel piggy enough on Thanksgiving.
You guys will go together well. You know, you were mentioning vegetarian dishes, and that's another thing. I don't know that if I've ever been to a Thanksgiving dinner that didn't have at least a couple of vegetarians, and you need to have something very delicious. It's not just turkey. So I know that a lot of readers have been, I mean, a lot of listeners have been sending in ideas for that.
Aaron Orr has suggested a whole bunch. Autumn vegetable and goat cheese tart with a poppy seed crust. You saw these, right?
Yeah, I saw that. Sounded delicious.
Wild mushroom cobbler. Whole brined and roasted cauliflower with Romesco sauce.
I just love that idea.
And yam, Swiss chard, and chipotle gratin.
Those, what I love about all of those is that they are main courses. They're focal points of the meal. You know, if you're not going to have a turkey, or if you're going to have a turkey, but you want something substantial and something celebratory, I think all of those would work really well. I love the roasted, the brined and roasted cauliflower. I have never brined a cauliflower, and I absolutely am going to try that. That sounds brilliant.
I love cauliflower, and it's still fresh around this time of year. She is serious, Erin Orr. She has a blog called BigSisLittleDish.com, and you can find those recipes there. Pam Brown from Woodstock will be doing a pan-seared cornmeal-crusted tofu with red wine fig reduction sauce.
Sounds fancy. That sounds great. I think also I gave a couple of recipes that'll be on your site that people can find their links to recipes that I did for the Times. One of them was really nice. It was a strata. It was a cornmeal broccoli rabe, basically like a casserole. And it was, what was great about this dish is that if you are a vegetarian, you can serve it as your main course. But if you are hosting and you have a turkey, you can serve it as a side dish. Non-vegetarians will really enjoy this as well. It's a delicious, just a delicious thing to have on the Thanksgiving table, and it's substantial enough for anybody who's not eating the turkey to make it a main part of their meal.
You also have pumpkin, white bean, and kale ragu.
That is a good one.
Stuffed butternut squash.
Stuffed butternut squash. Stuffed squash is a very classic thing. It's a very classic Thanksgiving side dish. It is also a great thing to have as your main course, especially if you get, you know, you don't just have to get a butternut squash. If you get one of those beautiful pumpkins or those beautiful blue Hubbard squashes that you can find this time of year, and you stuff that with pretty much any kind of grain stuffing that you like, wild rice or quinoa or brown rice, it's something that has a lot of different seasonings in it. It is a beautiful main course. You don't even, I mean, that can sit at the center of your table, and, you know, no one will even notice if there's a bird or not, frankly.
Laura Wilson wrote in to say she loves her token tofurkey.
Oh, the tofurkey.
But the key is her veggie gravy with Vegemite as a base, as well as sautéed mushrooms and red wine veggie stock. Now, what about making a perfect gravy? Do you have to mix in flour? You have to thicken it with flour?
You have to thicken it with something. You know, I have made gravies. You could make a really sort of thin gravy, like just a jus, if you just take the drippings and you just whisk in butter. You actually don't even necessarily need the starch. But a classic gravy, you know, the kind that you think of, the kind that just sort of screams Thanksgiving, the kind that you want to pour on your sandwich the next day, does have flour or a little bit of cornstarch, something, some kind of starch to really give it that silky quality. You can make gravy ahead. A lot of people don't know that. They get really nervous thinking, oh, I have to make the gravy at the last minute with the turkey drippings. But you can make it ahead. And then just take those turkey drippings that you have from the bottom of the pan and pour them right in so that you are going to spike it with that extra turkey flavor. But then you have the base all made, so it takes some of the anxiety off of the last-minute cooking. There are recipes for that. I know we have one on the Times website, but there are a lot of recipes out there for make-ahead gravy.
Steve from Queens wrote in to say he tried using a salt brine on an 18-pound turkey, and it came out too salty, than he much more than he wanted. How do you calculate the amount of salt, water, sugar, brine, et cetera, for a given size bird, turkey, or chicken?
That is a really good question. I know there are formulas out there, and I don't know off the top of my head what the ones for wet brines are, but I think we have this on the New York Times website. We have something called Essential Thanksgiving, and we have the ratio of salt per pound per turkey for a dry brine. The question is, how much liquid do you add? I would just do the dry brine. I think it's a half a teaspoon. Could it be a half a teaspoon per pound of turkey? Does that sound right? I don't remember, but it's on the website. And if you use that ratio, I would just say if you want to moisten it with a little bit of water. Yes, it's tricky. A wet brine is trickier than a dry brine because you also have to worry about, is it submerged enough? You know, is the brine touching?
There's always a little part that's sitting above
that
the water,
sticks out,
no matter
and then
how
that's,
big the pot is.
And then you have to keep turning it. You know, if you use a dry brine, you pat the salt mix evenly all around the turkey, you know you're getting an even brine. And that's important, too, because you don't want the legs to be saltier than the breast.
Is it the same whether you're using a large turkey or a small turkey?
Yes. Per pound, it's just per pound. You know,
so if you have a small turkey, now I'm not just talking about the salt. I'm talking about in general.
Oh.
Do you have to adjust things when you have a smaller turkey? Is it more like cooking a large chicken?
A small turkey is just easier to handle. I mean, an 18-pounder, putting that thing in the oven and, you know, trying to, you know, maneuver it, I find I prefer to have a smaller turkey. I mean, I really think sort of 10 to 12 pounds is ideal because you can, it's not too heavy to lift. You can kind of, you can turn it around if you need to. You can manipulate it. It's not that hard to carve. And then if you need extra meat, what I do is I buy a couple of extra drumsticks because in our family we like dark meat, but you could also buy an extra bone in turkey breast. You roast it alongside. Everything is just easier to manage. And then you still have this beautiful presentation of, oh, here is the turkey. And then you have the extra parts that you've roasted and you can control them better in terms of making them nicely cooked. And you have the kind of meat that you like, either dark meat or white meat.
My guest is Melissa Clark, whose column A Good Appetite appears Wednesdays in the food section of the New York Times, and you can follow her on Twitter at Good Appetite, one word. And you're listening to WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We're talking about alternatives to turkey, although we're also talking about turkey because you can't escape it on Thanksgiving. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Let's take a call from Joe from Flushing. Hi, Joe.
Leonard.
Yes, Joe.
I was telling your associate there that since it's my wife and myself only, we didn't want to be eating turkey for the next 2 weeks. So our alternative is a braised Cornish hen with apricots and dates, which is really great. And then in the Times, they had a recipe a couple of weeks ago for sweet potatoes with cranberry jalapeno chutney. That sounds like it would go good with that. So that's my alternative.
Now, of course, you can also buy turkey parts, can't you? You don't have to have a complete turkey.
No? I think Cornish hens taste a lot better.
I like Cornish hens.
You see, there are people out there who don't like turkey, and I think that's valid, too. And Cornish hens are delicious. But, yes, you are right. You can buy it for a smaller Thanksgiving. You can decide, do I want to have the breast or do I want to have the legs? Confit legs, which we were talking about before, are fantastic. You can do them in olive oil if you don't happen to have duck fat around. But also a nice roasted turkey breast, just a, you know, done really simply, A turkey breast is great when you don't roast it with the rest of the bird, because you can really control. You can just make it as juicy as you want. You don't have to worry about the legs cooking. So that's a nice alternative as well.
I suspect one of the reasons Joe likes the Cornish hens is because they have more flavor than a lot of the turkey that you find in the supermarket. But the other kinds, the heritage birds, could be quite expensive.
They are so expensive, but they're worth
Especially when you're buying an 18-pound
yes.
turkey.
I mean, that is true, which is why you should buy the smaller ones. But I guess then again, if you have to buy the parts, it all adds up. What is so great about a heritage bird is the flavor. It is so much more flavorful than a regular, what they call a broad-breasted white.
But don't they sometimes turn out a little drier than the other kind?
Not if you brine them. You know, dry brine or wet brine. If you brine your turkey, it'll probably, and you don't overcook it. I mean, that's another thing. Here's something that I do find about heritage birds, which sometimes throws people off. Often the meat is a slightly darker color than your typical supermarket turkey, which basically looks like a chicken in terms of the color of the meat. Heritage birds have, sometimes their dark meat is almost a little bit like a duck. It's a little bit brown, a little bit pink. So people get confused. And even though their thermometer says the turkey is done, they look at it and they say, oh, but this is pink. It can't be done. And then they overcook it. So just go by the thermometer and realize that your dark meat might have a pinkish hue. That is perfectly fine. As long as you're getting that 165 reading on the thermometer, you're good.
Charles from Park Slope. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Go ahead.
I don't know this is sacrilege, but last year I actually used for the first time a turkey cooking bag.
Ah.
And
why is that sacrilege?
Like I would normally season it and everything my mother taught me and all. But I decided, let me just try this out. And I put it in the bag, put the flour in the bag, punched some holes in it. And at first it was done in much less time than it normally would be. And it came out perfectly and juicy and everything.
Now, what about the skin? What about the skin? Was it crispy? See, I worry that the skin would be soggy.
You know what? I took it out and then I left it in the oven low for like maybe another half hour or so it would get a little browner and a little crispier.
Okay. Well, I think that I have never tried one personally. Have you ever tried one?
Yeah.
And what was your experience?
The same as his.
It was great?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. I need
it
to explore this.
It keeps it moist, but then, yeah, you want to take it out and crisp up the skin.
And then you want to crisp up the skin.
Yeah.
I like to. What do? You put it at 500 at the end for 15 minutes or half an hour or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
Nice. I didn't realize that.
And yet I haven't done it in years.
That's so funny. So it worked once and then...
Well, you know...
You have to get the bag.
Relationships change. Life changes. I don't want to go into those details. We have a lot of people who have written in. Len from Westchester wrote in that decades ago had a Chinese cookbook from Joyce Chen. I remember that book.
Yeah,
it was great.
Yeah.
Her method for getting some of the fat out of the duck was to perforate it all over, zap it for several minutes with a hairdryer and the high setting. So.
Yes, I have tried that too, but you know, you really have to. It takes a while with that hairdryer. I get bored. I'd rather blanch it. But it's the same. It's the same idea. The idea is that you do have to perforate it all over because you need a place for the fat to escape. You need the skin to be nicked. But I find the blanching. You could do either one. What you want to do is apply heat so that the fat starts to run out and the skin starts to tighten. Same concept.
Well, as far as blanching goes, I've always relied on the. Forget that joke. Okay.
really? You're going to leave me hanging here?
Well, it was a Blanche DuBois joke.
Okay.
Melissa from New York City wrote into our show page that she bastes poultry with equal parts tamarind paste and honey during roasting, which lacquers the skin nicely.
That's brilliant. Tamarind paste is so smart because honey is obviously very sweet and tamarind paste is very sour, so you put them together. Oh, I love that. I'm going to steal that. Thank you.
And Mike from Cold Spring, New York, suggests miso gravy.
Ooh, you know, that's a good idea. I'll stir in a little miso into your gravy because miso has tons of flavor. It's got that, you know, kind of complex umami savoriness that we love so much. I think that's brilliant.
And Andrea from Philadelphia wrote in that she had Thanksgiving with vegan friends a few years ago, and they made a vegetable pot pie for the main course, delicious and festive.
Mm.
She said she contributed squash soup as the appetizer, and they had some of the traditional sides like cranberry sauce.
All sounds great. In fact, there's a really nice, I just remember this, somewhere on the Times website, there's something called a harvest tart. So similar to a vegetable pot pie, it's a vegan recipe. It's with olive oil in the crust, and that would make a really nice, if you're looking for something based in pastry or like a pie or a tart, that would make a really nice vegan Thanksgiving main course.
Taylor Burney on Twitter writes, we're having capon.
Ooh.
Any preparation suggestions?
Capon. Capon is great. That's another festive poultry that you would not normally buy. That's good for something like Thanksgiving or
that's
Christmas.
That's a male bird.
Yeah. That's been castrated, right?
Yes.
Is that, and they're supposed to be very plump
so
and juicy.
So they get plumper.
Yeah. I've had capon, and it's been absolutely delicious. I think you just cook it like chicken. I've had it, but I haven't actually made it myself. But I would recommend doing it pretty much like chicken.
And then a couple of people wrote in about pumpkins. Ken Locke from Queens writes on Twitter, can you recommend a tasty pumpkin dessert that isn't pumpkin pie? And then Kurt from Manhattan raves about your brandied pumpkin pie. One year he did a vegetarian Thanksgiving for friends, only to have the vegetarians come out during the meal as eating hot dogs. I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, you know, certain vegetarians do make
really
exceptions for things like hot dogs and bacon. You know, everyone has their own way of eating.
But do you have do you have a suggestion for doing something with pumpkin other than pumpkin pie?
You know what is great is pumpkin layer cake. Have you ever had a pumpkin? There's pumpkin cheesecake, which is also pretty traditional. But if you want to get away from sort of pie-like things, and a cheesecake is kind of like a pie because it's the same custard. A pumpkin layer cake, it's like a carrot cake, basically, except or like an applesauce cake, but you use pumpkin puree instead of carrots or applesauce. Frost it with a cream cheese frosting, maybe with some cinnamon in it. That is a delicious and very festive dessert that you don't see very often.
Joe from Brooklyn will be cooking a boneless turkey breast, but he'll make it into turkey tonnato by putting a tuna anchovy sauce on it.
Oh, that sounds so good. That's great. I love that.
Well, you love anything that says anchovy.
I do. Anything that says anchovies.
Now, we don't have any more time, but we also have posted a recipe of yours for maple bacon glazed pork loin with roasted Brussels sprouts and butternut squash. And Brussels sprouts and butternut squash are two things we associate with this holiday.
Yeah. See, if you want to skip poultry altogether, but you still want to have meat, nothing like a roasted pork loin makes a happy entree to any meal.
And you get an awful lot of meat out of it. You get leftovers as well.
Exactly. A pork sandwich is just as good as a turkey sandwich.
Melissa Clark is a reporter for the Food Department for the New York Times. Her column, A Good Appetite, is in the food section every Wednesday. You can also follow her on Twitter at Good Appetite. You have a blog as well.
Yeah, it's let's just say it's being restored.
You're letting it lapse for a while?
Yeah. We're letting it lie fallow.
Well, thank you so much for coming by today. We've been talking about alternatives to turkey, but we've also been talking a lot of turkey.
Well, happy Turkey Day to you.
Blue skies smiling at me. Nothing but blue skies do I see. Bluebirds singing their song. Nothing but bluebirds from now on. Never saw the sun shining so bright. Never saw things going so right. Noticing the days hurrying by, when you're in love, my eyes they fly. Blue days.
Do you believe in fate? Well, imagine having your life's calling come to you for a nickel. That's how much Sheila Jordan, a high school student in Detroit, Michigan, put in a jukebox to hear Charlie Parker play his famous composition, Now's the Time. She was hooked after the first four notes. She says, I instantly knew that was the music I had been waiting to hear and would dedicate my life to singing. And that's what she's been doing for 70 years now. Sheila Jordan cultivated a circle of friends that included not only Charlie Parker, but also Charles Mingus, Max Roach, Lee Konitz, and her former husband, Duke Jordan, among others. An innovative vocalist, a generous teacher, lifelong civil rights advocate, Ms. Jordan, who was recently honored with an NEA Jazz Master's Award, is the subject of a new biography called Jazz Child, A Portrait of Sheila Jordan by Ellen Johnson. I'm very pleased to welcome Sheila Jordan to our show.
Hello. Hi. It's great to be here.
And we open with you singing with just a bass.
Yes.
Now, it was one thing when Sonny Rollins did that sort of thing, but for a vocalist, that must be very difficult to just stay in tune.
Yeah, you have to be very careful. You know, it's a lot of tuning up and can't be a lot of noise in the room when you're performing. You know, fans or refrigerators will set your intonation. You have to keep working on your pitch. But I've done it, and something I've done since 1950, maybe 52, something like that.
53. And you say that you think you were a bass player in a former life?
Yeah, well, I love the bass. I love the way it looks. I love the sound. And it's such a delicate instrument, and yet it's so huge.
But there are so many different styles of bass playing.
Yes.
Do you have to adjust to each? It's not the same thing as having a piano player play chords behind you.
Well, I choose the bass player because I do a whole concert of just bass and voice. And they're all little things that I've worked out. Like, I do a dance medley for Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. I do a thing for Bird and Fats Waller. I do songs all together that I've put together. We made little excerpts from, you know, these great players. And then I do a thing on Miles. Actually, Blue Skies starts the Miles medley. Then I go into Miles and sing his solos.
You put words to his solos, or you scat them?
No, I didn't put words to Freddie Freeloader on Miles Davis, which I'm sure you know. John Hendricks did.
Album.
John Hendricks did, but I do that. And then I do, I just scat his solo on Now's the Time, Miles' solo.
You recently returned from a series of workshops and concerts in Germany, and later this week you're going to France, I understand.
Tomorrow.
And then in early December, you'll be touring Japan.
Yes.
Today's your 86th birthday?
Yeah.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Leonard.
You worked at a day job until you were 58. Are you making up for lost time now?
I don't know. All of a sudden, I guess people are taking me serious. Say, hey, she must be serious. She's still trying to do it. So, no, but even when I was working in an office, you know, I worked in an office because I had to take care of my little girl at the time. She was a baby, so... But I did the music. I always found a place to do the music, and that's what I tell the students. You might have to support this music until it can support you. And there's a whole chapter in my book that Ellen Johnson so graciously and so wonderfully wrote on my teaching and
so this,
my whole attitude.
This is an authorized biography.
Pardon me?
This is an authorized biography.
Yes.
And this, the story that's told growing up, it's rather sad. You had a hard, scrabble childhood.
I did.
That was marked by a series of abandonments.
Yes.
Your mother wasn't there for you?
No, she couldn't help herself. She was very young when she had me, and my father left her. I think I didn't see my father until I was like towards the end of his life, you know.
And then your grandparents.
My grandparents
brought you up, but they were not exactly the ideal.
Well, they couldn't help it. I mean, she had a lot of children, my grandmother. She had 10 kids, and I was part of that family, and there was a lot of alcoholism on my grandfather's side. So I grew up in alcoholism, so I know all about that. And my mother, unfortunately, died from the disease. So when I went to live with her in my teens, you know, I didn't stay there very long with her. I left home as soon as I got out of high school. I had a job, and I was taking care of me.
But later, when you got involved in the jazz world, there was not only alcohol, there was a lot of drugs.
Yes.
Had you been prepared for witnessing that because of what you'd seen when you were a kid?
Well, you know, sometimes that disease is just hereditary. The alcoholism was hereditary for me, I believe. But Charlie Parker was, contrary to what a lot of musicians say about Bird, he never encouraged me or anybody to use drugs, you know. He was always, don't do this, don't do this.
Others
It'll
did it
kill
just
you.
Simply because he was their hero.
Yeah, that's right.
You moved back to Detroit from Pennsylvania.
When I was about, yeah, I was about 14, I guess.
With your mother?
Yes, to live with my mother.
And was that still a problem?
Well, yeah, I had a ugly stepfather who took advantage of me, so I had to get out of there.
Why do you think those four notes, which we mentioned earlier, some listeners might remember them as the opening of the R&B song, The Hucklebuck, were so significant to you when you heard them?
Well, you know, I'd been singing ever since I was a little kid because it was an escape for me. I was so unhappy, but I always felt good when I sang. So I sang all the time. I was constantly singing. And I know I had an uncle who was like my brother. He was about 3 years older than me. He said, "Will you shut her up? She never wants to stop. Shut her up. She can't sing." You know, but I kept singing anyway. And it helped me. And so I didn't know what kind of music I wanted to sing. But I was on a couple of talent shows in Pennsylvania and also in Detroit later. But I remember this guy sent a letter. He found out where we lived in Pennsylvania. And he sent a letter to me. And my grandmother opened it. And this guy was proposing. And my grandmother wrote the letter back, and she said, "I don't think so, mister. She's only 8 years old." She thought I was older.
You were about 16 when you heard "Now's the Time" by Charlie Parker?
I was about 14 or 15, yeah.
There's a quote from you in the book regarding the first time you heard Charlie Parker in a live performance at Jazz at the Philharmonic. You said, "It was incredible. I knew in that moment that I was right, that this is the music for me. This is the music I want to dedicate my life to because it frees me, it helps me. Bird was my savior, and I have him to thank."
That's right.
There was an epiphany?
Well, you know, it also happened when I heard "Now's the Time," because I said, "Oh, this looks weird. This looks strange. Charlie Parker and his reboppers. I said, "Oh, I wonder what that sounds like." Four notes, and I was hooked.
How long after you heard him were you able to meet Charlie Parker?
Well, he came to Detroit, and actually I wrote my blues, and in my blues I sing about how I tried to get in the club to hear him sing, and I forged my mother's birth certificate and wore a hat with a veil, and the guy at the door said, "Hey, little white girl, go home and do your homework." So Bird was by the door. He heard that, and I went around in the alley. I said, "I'm going to hear this music."
You were a little white girl.
Yeah.
You were a little white girl going to predominantly black clubs and black neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Was that okay with everybody?
No, it was terrible. I mean, I was always getting taken down to the police station or being stopped by police, you know.
What are you
asking
doing here?
Why. Yeah, I started telling them I was black. I said, "I got to get out of here. I'm, you know, this is where I want to be. And secondly, I'm colorblind. I just know people for what they are and who they are. And that's the only way I can get through my life is to be with people I want to be with."
My guest is Sheila Jordan, who is the subject of a biography called Jazz Child, a portrait of Sheila Jordan written by Ellen Johnson. Detroit was a home to a lot of jazz musicians during the 40s
yes,
and 50s.
Yes, it was.
Thad and Elvin Jones, Milt Jackson, Kenny Burrell, the future Yusuf Lateef, Pepper Adams. It must have been a very exciting time.
Well, yes, because I hung out with Barry Harris, Kenny Burrell, and Tommy Flanagan. We were all the same age, approximately the same age. And there was a club, though, in downtown Detroit called the Club Sudan, and they didn't sell alcohol there, so we could go there and hear the music.
When did you start singing professionally to modern jazz?
I guess when I came to New York. I was always doing, like, sitting in with gigs. I mean, Bird, when Bird would come to town in Detroit, which wasn't that often, but when he would come to town, he'd always ask Skeeter, Mitch, and I to sit in, and we'd do our bebop head.
You were part of a little group.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Skeeter, Mitch, and Gene, we were called. And we would do all the Charlie Parker heads, and we'd sing in his ear, and he'd say, "Come on up and sing it with me." So we'd get up on stage and sing with Bird. That was a thrill. Dizzy Gillespie, too.
You wrote original lyrics to Thelonious Monk's "Round Midnight," and and your future husband, Duke Jordan, heard you sing that?
I don't know. Yes, he did. I was at the Club Sudan, and I sang "Round Midnight" and sang the lyrics that I wrote, which Tommy Flanagan hated. He said, "Those are raggedy lyrics."
But it wound up getting you connected to your future husband.
Absolutely. But Duke, you know, said she sings on the chord changes, and I was singing on the changes. And he was very surprised about that.
Well, for listeners who don't understand, if you're playing an instrument and you play on the chord changes, that's a lot easier to work out. You just know where your fingers have to be. But it's not so easy to do that when you're singing.
Yeah, well, I heard the chord changes in my ear, so.
You then moved to New York.
Then I moved to New York.
Because this was the center of jazz?
I moved to New York to be closer to Charlie Parker's music, and I moved to New York because I wanted to get away from all the racial prejudice and from being put down with the people that I wanted to be with. I was colorblind, man. I didn't see. I just knew people for what they were and how I felt. And
Detroit was a lot worse than New York?
Oh, it was terrible. It was just terrible. I almost got Barry Harris killed. We went to a club he was playing at, and Skeeter, Mitch, and I sang, and we were leaving the club, and when we walked out the door, Barry said, run, run. All of the guys that were sitting at the bar, the white guys, it was a Polish bar, chased us. If they had caught us, they would have killed us. We just got on the Woodward Avenue streetcar in time. So that was terrible. But I came to New York thinking, I want to be near Bird's music, and I also want to... to free myself from this racial prejudice.
And Charlie Parker obviously appreciated you. He used to introduce you as the singer with the million-dollar
yeah,
ears.
Yeah, he told me that when I was a kid, yeah.
And then you married Duke Jordan, his pianist of
I
the
did.
Time.
I did.
Had a baby called Tracy in 1954. And then, how did that change your life?
You mean having Tracy?
Yeah.
Well, it didn't change my life so much, except that I had somebody in my life that I could love and who would love me back. And so I supported her, you know. I took care of her. I did the best I could as a single mother, you know, because Duke, unfortunately, had the cunning, baffling, powerful disease of heroin addiction, and he couldn't help, so he was never there. But
almost everybody you knew was taking drugs.
Oh, they were all, well, they all wanted to be like Bird. They thought they could play like Bird, you know, but they couldn't.
And Charlie Parker, when he was clean, said, you know, I play better when I'm not high, so
yes.
They should have listened to
there
him.
There you go. So that's so true. But you don't know that at the time. But anyway, when I came to New York, I thought I was going to be in the city that where everybody was accepted, and I was badly mistaken. Yes, on the jazz scene, absolutely it was cool. But, you know, I almost got killed on the street just in front of my building where I lived. I had gone out to have a dinner with two artist friends of mine who happened to be Afro-American, and we were coming back, and four guys in the corner bar, four white guys from Jersey, jumped us, and they held three guys held my two friends, and the other guy knocked me down on the street and was kicking me, knocked my tooth out. I was bleeding, and all of a sudden I looked up and I saw a guy walking with a gun. I said, that's it, I'm going to die over this, but I know I'm right. He was a plainclothesman. He saved my life.
You were the second woman vocalist signed to Blue Note Records.
That's true.
And you were working, and yet at the same time, you had to do day jobs until you were 58 years old?
Yes. Well, I didn't go out there and try to push, you know, and I didn't have an agent.
Which had a lot of fans.
Yeah, it was wonderful. And I had my little job at the Page Street two nights a week, and I had my office job, and I wasn't out there trying to really do anything except keep the music alive and support myself and my daughter.
Later in your career, you became one of the pioneers of vocal jazz education.
Yes.
You had studied with Lenny Tristano. You're teaching at City University of New York,
mm-hmm.
among other institutions. Any of your students go on to make you proud?
Well, then I also started it was beginning, and the teacher left, and I took over Jazz in July in the summer for 2 weeks.
We're going out with you singing The Crossing from your album with Cameron Brown called Celebration. Sheila Jordan is the subject of Ellen Johnson's biography called Jazz Child, A Portrait of Sheila Jordan. It is published by Roman and Littlefield. And I thank you so much for being on our show. It's been such a pleasure.
Well, aren't you the sweetest to have me? And on my birthday, what a beautiful birthday present. Thank you so much, Leonard.
But
thank
better
you.
To listen to you sing than to hear me sing happy birthday.
I'd like to hear you sing.
I'll do it when we're off the air.
Okay.
There is no time or season, and there is no fear or strain. Take your troubles to the crossing. It's where joy outweighs the pain.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 1977, Look magazine sent photographer Stephen Shames to the Bronx, where he began photographing a group of boys coming of age in one of the toughest and poorest neighborhoods in the United States. Mr. Shames earned the trust and respect of the boys, and over the next two decades, they allowed him into their lives and into their homes. Now he has published a book called Bronx Boys, featuring 123 duotone photographs that capture life in the borough from 1977 through 2000. It's published by the University of Texas Press, and I'm pleased that it brings award-winning photographer Stephen Shames and one of the Bronx boys, Jose Pancho Munoz, to our studio today. Hello.
Hey. And how are you? Thanks for having us.
Stephen, before you began this project, didn't you photograph the Black Panthers from 1966 to 1973?
I did.
So you like these big projects?
I love these big projects. That's really what I love about photography, is getting totally involved in a subject or a community.
Should I assume that the Bronx Boys was a more personal project?
It was.
You first took photographs for Look magazine at the request of its managing editor, John Durniak. Hadn't the magazine already ceased publication?
It had, but I guess it was coming back. Or John told me it was coming back, but it didn't make it. I photographed for one day and actually took what was the cover became the cover picture of the book, or that picture
of a boy jumping between rooftops.
Exactly. And that kind of hooked me. That's become my, some people think that's my iconic image. And after I took that image, I thought, wow, this is great photos. I've got to, go back here. And then John Durniak called me a couple of, days after, I had done my first shoot. And he said, well, the magazine's done, but I wasn't done.
Well, what did you think you were going to do with the pictures if you just kept on shooting past the assignment? You were going to be paid by Look initially, and now right. No more.
I never worried about that. I mean, a lot of photographers do personal projects, and it just became a personal project.
Tell us about the first days that you were working in the Bronx. How did you come to know the young men that you call the Bronx Boys?
The first day I was on Tremont Avenue, and I got this picture, and I also took a picture of a motorcycle gang. And it turned out that the mom of this boy who was jumping had helped the leader of the Claremont Boys, which was the motorcycle gang. And he, would eat at her house, and, she took care of him. And so she introduced me to them, and it just kind of went from there. People just accepted me, and I just did pictures.
Pancho, how old were you when he started taking pictures of you?
I was about 15, 16 years old.
Are you surprised by what you see when you look at these photographs of your whole childhood?
Very, very surprised.
You probably wouldn't have remembered some of these things.
No, I remembered a lot, because I remember Steve being around a lot, but it was amazing at that time.
You say there weren't too many white guys hanging around the Bronx in your neighborhood.
There wasn't too many white people doing what Steve was doing, because we lived right across the street from Fordham University, so all the white kids used to come to the bar right near our block. But there was nobody staying there after hours taking photos. That was not happening.
And you say sometimes he got himself into dangerous situations.
Yeah, there was a lot of situations that Steve got into that I was like, whoa. And that's what I think is the magic of the book, that he was able to stay in these places in those times. That, there was nothing scripted. Everything was just really real.
Has this neighborhood changed a lot over the years since the pictures were taken?
The neighborhood has changed. It changed a lot, but it's still a lot of not good things going on there. Not like I wish, the block was now.
Stephen, you describe the Bronx at the time as having a terrible beauty, like an urban moonscape. Has that changed at all, or can I still find that urban moonscape?
In certain areas of the Bronx, I think you can still find it. I think the area that was most like that, which was in the 138th, 140th Street, has actually become gentrified, and there's art galleries there, and a lot of people have moved there. But if you remember, at the time that I was writing about was right after President Carter went up to the Bronx and held a news conference in front of these vacant, you know, abandoned buildings, and that's kind of the image I had in my mind when I was writing.
And he promised that there would be renewal, but it didn't come as quickly as anybody had expected.
No, that was the Ferreira Dinkins and Koch days. That was crazy, man. It's funny how they didn't. It was just weird at that time.
Stephen, you say sometimes you felt terrified of the Bronx. Other times you felt like it was home. So you have an ambivalent relationship?
Well, I think Pancho and a lot of people have an ambivalent relationship. I mean, the people were really warm and wonderful. So that felt like home. And I think Pancho feels the same way, that we're family. And a lot of the Bronx boys, we feel like family. And in fact, the Bronx boys survived by making a family for themselves. They actually brought themselves up and looked after each other. So that part was wonderful. On the other hand, there was a lot of violence. People were getting shot. There was drugs. Buildings.
Were the shootings right near you? Or did you have to duck?
I never really had to duck, but there were. You could hear gunshots.
And Pancho, one of the people in the book, Martin Doan's a key figure in the story, says violence could escalate quickly from fistfights to gunfights. How many of your friends were killed?
Wow, boy, a lot, like over 20 to 40 friends that I know. And that's a lot when, you know, only have a handful of friends.
I haven't had 40 friends in my lifetime.
Exactly. And when that many people go, it's crazy. And to say something that Steve said earlier about the Bronx, where it's beautiful, it was beautiful in the point where there was nothing nice around it. It was all graffiti and everything was abandoned buildings. But yet we made beauty somehow there. It just became beautiful what we created.
Martin Drones also said that earning respect in the Bronx was more important than earning money.
Yeah. Because respect, you know, it brung you money. It brung you everything else you needed. You know, you needed to have that credential, you know, that stay away from, you know.
Well, how did you get that respect? Was it just simply being scarier than other people?
Yeah, it wasn't not a lot of nice things were going on to get that respect. You had to be pretty mean and pretty rough, you know?
You say in the beginning your mother wasn't sure about this guy taking all these pictures. Why did she eventually decide that Stephen was okay?
Well, I guess, you know, Steve was so, you know, and when I went back to Steve's magic, you know, he had that little charisma thing to make everybody feel comfortable. You know, Steve never offered anybody, you know, here's this money to take a photo. No, he just said, just be natural, just be you, and that's where the magic comes out. But my mom felt comfortable around Steve.
You say that once you got to know Stephen, he had this father mentor quality. So did he mentor you?
Yeah, he did mentor me in a lot of ways. He did. I did have my dad who lived on the other side of town, but it's not the same when you just live with your mom and your dad's on the other side of town. You still need that little person to tell you, hey, you know, focus in on what's important.
And sometimes you called him dad.
Yeah. Steve was like my dad at some point, man. Yes, he was a good person for a long time.
Stephen, did you intend to become a mentor to these young men, or did this just happen by accident?
It just kind of happened. I mean, I was photographing them. I spent 20 years up there, and when you spend a lot of time, you make personal relationships. It wasn't something that we planned. It's just something that happened. I mean, they were great. They were great kids. I think something Pancho said earlier, which is very interesting, about how there was graffiti and ugliness all around, but they created beauty. I think what's really impressed me and kept me with the project, and I think what's really great about the book, is it's about human survival, and it's about how humans create beauty out of anything. I mean, people did art in the concentration camps. You know what I'm saying? It's like human beings have a need to create beauty, and these kids who weren't thinking of themselves as artists created a family and created beauty in the Bronx. And to me, that's what's very, I think that's very spiritual about the book and about the Bronx boys. And I think that's, you know, what's unique.
Well, the book is called Bronx Boys, Photographs of Stephen Chambers, with a text by Martin Doans and Jose Pancho Munoz. When did you start writing, Jose?
I don't write. I just felt that's my heart right there, because that book, like, I wonder what people see when they look at pictures of us, because I know what I see when I see those photos. I see my whole life. So that's why it was easy just to say what I needed to say, you know?
Some of these pictures are rather shocking. We have on our show page an image of a friend helping a 15-year-old shoot heroin on the roof of a building in the Bronx. Right.
That's what it was, though, at that time. It wasn't, you know, there wasn't a lot of nice things in the area. Everything was kind of, you know, we created our niceness. I remember the only four nice things in the Bronx were Yankee Stadium, Botanical Gardens, Bronx Zoo, and Fordham University. After that, it seems like nobody else cared, you know?
I like Arthur Avenue, too.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I missed that. Yeah, yeah.
Although a lot of the Bronx boys, for a variety of reasons, couldn't go to Arthur Avenue.
Yeah, right. It was mixed.
You weren't allowed?
Well, the residents of Arthur Avenue didn't welcome them. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Stephen, what did you have to do to earn the trust and respect of the boys, since respect was so important in the society?
I think as a photographer, what you do is you just act as a person. You just act... you know, you don't do anything special. I think people get a feeling for you. If they feel that you're being honest, if they feel that you're not making fun of them, if they feel that you're portraying their life in a real way, then people will accept you. I think that's the secret.
Some of these pictures are rather intimate, personal. Did you ever, did any of them ever tell you, please don't photograph this?
Actually, I can't recall that ever happened.
Nah, he came in one of the photos. It's me and my girlfriend laying down, and Steve called me in the morning, and I said, "Come on in," and we just relaxed, and he took photos. It was nothing, you know. It was just Steve. Steve became like a part of the building at times. He was just around. You know?
In fact, he said, "I'm not here. Just be you."
Yeah.
In some of the photographs, the boys are playing at being adults. In others, it's hard to tell whether it's play or it's real. So you were witnessing these guys growing up.
Exactly.
Martin Doan says that he had two choices, either to go to jail and die or try to be a normal person. Did you feel the same way?
Yeah, it wasn't nothing positive to look to at that time. It was more like dying almost at that time, you know, but that's the most interesting part about it, because you get to see everybody's path. You know, everybody's path is so crazy. So many died. So many did well. And, you know, that's the interesting thing about the book.
Well, and you actually did well. I mean, Pancho has his own business now. He has three wonderful daughters, one of whom's in college, and his other daughters are honor students.
I got very lucky through some mentors and some families. And
how are your daughters' lives different from yours? How is their childhood different?
Oh, I tell them stories about what I went through all the time. And you know, when they say, "Oh, Dad, you don't know what you're talking about," I say, "Hey, I got proof to show you.
Look, I got these pictures.
I got pictures. You better listen to what I'm telling you."
The Bronx Police feature in some of this work. What was your relationship with the cops, Pancho? Did you feel that they were there to protect you?
Nah. At that time, it wasn't protection. It was just, you know, they were just there. I mean, that's how come I was amazed at Steve, because, like, there was, you know, it's not like now you can just call a 911. And, you know, at that time you had to go to a booth and press a button, you know. By the time that, you know, that button even answers, you know, you're just dead, you know. So that was real interesting what Steve did at that time.
In some of these photographs, Stephen, the boys are in dangerous situations. I mentioned shooting drugs or being violent. Did you ever feel conflicted about whether to step in and help, or did you just continue taking the pictures?
Well, of course, you always feel conflicted. But when you're a photographer, you just had to take the pictures. That's what you're there to do. And more to the point, in other situations in my photographic career, which is almost – it's been 48 years, the few times – where I actually have intervened, it's either not made a difference, or actually sometimes it can make things worse. So if you're going to be a photographer, then you should be a photographer. If you want to be a social worker, you should put down your camera and become a social worker. That's really what it's about.
I get the feeling that you did serve, whether you meant to or not, something of a role of a social worker for these kids. But you say that these photographs are not a documentation. How would you prefer them to be seen?
I see them more as a poem. It's really a very personal, artistic project, a poem of these kids growing up in a very tough situation, and as I said before, them surviving and creating beauty where there was very little.
And they're all black and white, printed in duotone here, because that makes it feel very much like these are the photographs as they would come out from the hypo.
Right.
We have some images.
It's a beautifully printed book. Yeah. I mean, the University of Texas, which published the book, and my editors there and the people who worked on it, I think they did a fabulous job. I'm really happy with the book.
I love the book as well.
Are you surprised that Fordham University Press didn't publish it?
No. Well, I love the book. It's a great book. I mean, anybody can look at the book. If you live in Russia, you can enjoy the book, you know?
Stephen Chames is the author of 7 previous books, including Outside the Dream, Child Poverty in America, which won the Kodak Crystal Eagle Award for Impact in Photojournalism, The Black Panthers, and his photos are in the permanent collections of the International Center for Photography, the National Portrait Gallery, the Museum of Photography Arts, and the Museum of Fine Arts Houston. His latest book is Bronx Boys, and it has a text by Martin Dones and by Jose Pancho Munoz, who's also been a guest today. It's published by the University of Texas Press. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.